Is this the man behind George Soros? And America is funding a war to the tune of billions of dollars that we're told is being fought for the sake of a vague term that not one person has yet to actually define. This is the Propaganda Report's Drive Time News Blast. I am Brad Binkley. Happy Thursday, everyone. I hope you all remembered to wish American hero Volodymyr Zelensky a happy birthday yesterday. We owe him that much. Now, if you didn't do that, hopefully you were able to, at the very least, send him your life savings and whatever weapons you have lying around the house. I know that's what I did because I'm a patriot, and that's what patriots do. They send Zelensky homemade weapons packages. So he better be looking out for that mail because he's getting some good stuff. I sent him 3 pepper spray keychains, 2 tactical utility pins, and 1 unused rape whistle. Oh, and a dozen army green V-neck t-shirts from Target. This is a top-notch package here. Now, if you don't have any weapons lying around, you can send them. He did make an Amazon wish list for you to go off of. His top 2 requests are brand new copies of Mein Kampf and nudes of Eva Braun, which you can find those just about anywhere. Frame them, send them over there. We got to do what we can for this war effort. Make America, make the world safe for democracy. I mean, we're ungrateful if we don't at least send him an Eva Braun nude for his frickin' birthday. Fun fact, Zelensky shares a birthday with none other than Grammy award-winning singer and songwriter Alicia Keys, which is really pretty synchronistic when you think about it, because if there's one thing that Volodymyr Zelensky is, it's a girl on fire. And Putin better watch out, because that hot bitch is coming for his head. Happy birthday, Zelensky. Stay safe over there on your green screen, pal. What I want to do today is introduce y'all to a guy who has the most global deep statey background of anyone that I've ever encountered in my years of research. This is a guy who some actually believe is pulling George Soros' strings. And he could very well be. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play you guys some things that he had to say at Davos, and then I'm going to give you some information on his background and why it's relevant not only to America, but to the state of Georgia specifically, here where I live, and I know many of you do as well. But before we do that, I want to start with something that I found to be revealing that happened in that Davos discussion, Democracy, the Way Forward, or more accurately named, it would have been the New World Order, the Way Forward. During that session, the snooty moderator asked the Ukrainian representative on the panel, the attractive younger woman who the others were oogling over, that she was the chair of Ukraine's Center for Civil Liberties. The question asked by Adam Tooze, the moderator, it to me just clearly shows how all this Ukraine messaging is just total propaganda. I mean, we knew that, but to me, nothing illustrates how stupid all of this is than this. And it makes America look really dumb. Here it is. Oh, and on the background here is George Soros and the man that I'm about to introduce you to, and Stella's artwork again, some more Build Backs Better artwork here. Here's the clip.
Democracy, as the other panelists are describing it, is a messy business. It's a contested business. It's a dirty business. So this thing that we are, you, your people, are laying down their lives to defend is a ambiguous, to say the least, prize to win. Do you have a vision of how Ukrainian democracy emerges? It presumably is not a vision of a return to the status quo ante before the war, is it? Or do you have a vision of how a democratic politics could be animated by, informed by, inspired, changed by the war?
That is extraordinary. Is that not something that should have been asked before hundreds of billions worth of weapons packages were just sent over there? Should we not maybe have first sat down with Zelensky and NATO and made sure that we don't have different understandings of what that word democracy means? Should we not have laid out a concrete definition of democracy that we all agree on, you know, up front, before arming Nazis? I don't know about you, but if I'm about to hand over some artillery rockets and the keys to my Abrams tanks to some dude that has a swastika tattoo, I'd kind of like to make sure that we're all on the same page about what the hell we even mean when we say the word democracy. And here this guy has the audacity to show that. I mean, we knew that, but he just openly talks about how it's an ambiguous word. I mean, we've been told that we have to support them for a year now. They've insisted that we send all those weapons packages. They've insisted that we stand in solidarity, and they've demonized people who object to it, yet they don't even offer a concrete definition of the thing they insist that we must support. I mean, it's crazy. It does have a definition, actually. They're just not going to say it because it's a lot harder to mobilize the citizens of the world to rally them behind Ukraine if the message is, we must support Ukraine for the sake of the international order. Stand in solidarity with the international order. That just doesn't give people the tingly, warm, patriotic feelings inside like democracy does. That doesn't really make people want to put a Ukraine flag in their Twitter profile. They're using the term as, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, what's called in the propaganda literature a glittering generality. They have all these people worldwide who have conflicting interests, who they need to mobilize and organize under the umbrella of this one grand cause. So they use a vaguely defined term that evokes emotion, that everyone who hears it projects their own personal meaning of what that is into it, which is not at all what the people who are propagating it mean by it. But that personal meaning is what motivates the individuals. And by leaving it vague like that, they can manipulate those masses under the guise of that term to support any fascist cause that they want to push forward, as long as people are buying into it. And when it comes to mobilizing the world public, like they're trying to do right now, if they were to start concretely defining things like this, those definitions would come into conflict with those personal projections that were motivating the individuals. And people would be like, no, I didn't know that's what you meant by that. No, that's not at all what I meant. I'm not here to stand in solidarity with your new world order. And all of the support would dissipate. I mean, I know stuff like this is routine at this point, which is extraordinary in and of itself. But when you step back and think about, like I said a moment ago, all of the stuff they've done this past year, the insistence, the demonization, the grand shows by Zelensky around the world, virtually live in Congress, the standing ovations, the Ukraine flags and all the Twitter profiles. This is a historic propaganda campaign, in part because of its scale. I mean, it's global. This is a global cooperation on this campaign, but also because its effectiveness is waning. People are getting tired of it. It's a joke. It's not working anymore. This is like the largest mass communication experiment in the history of mankind. There's no doubt they're getting data, taking notes, and trying to improve upon it. But man, have they jumped the shark. And the little green man is the star of the show. All right, let's move on to Soros's bestie. This is a guy who some believe is pulling George Soros's strings. He could very well be. He certainly shares Soros's love of interfering in the politics and elections of other countries. His name is Lord Mark Malik Brown. He's British. Some people call him Malik. And we're going to hear him give four lessons that he's learned throughout his long career of causing uprisings, triggering the overthrow of sitting presidents, installing new presidents. We're going to hear him talk about tactics that he is actually currently using right now in the state of Georgia with Stacey Abrams. So we get to hear him describe those. And he's been trying to push electronic voting machines on America and other countries since long before Trump ever became president. A book about a company, which I'm going to tell you more about that in a second, said that Brown had a vision of a global electronic democracy. And he would tell his clients, replace the concept of class and class antagonism with the concept of the political consumer. And that an election isn't always some inevitable play of historical forces. It sounds like he's suggesting they could be manipulated to me. In a 2018 article, The Spectator wrote that Malik Brown had done much to undermine democratic rule. He helped overthrow Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines in 1986, was part of the team with Soros that set up the International Criminal Court, used almost exclusively against African leaders. He supported the overthrow of Libyan ruler Gaddafi, and he is an integral part of the soft power regime change operations, which the National Endowment for Democracy took over from the CIA, NATO, and MI6. Most of these regime change color revolutions require reliable mechanisms for vote fraud. And this article was written before 2020. The Spectator then goes on to say that the bottom line is that Lord Malik Brown's globalist forces have hijacked the entire landscape of electronic voting machines, have weaponized them, and are poised to strike in the 2018 midterm elections. Interesting. And then they called him Lord Malik Vader. And they say the claim that Malik Brown is controlled by George Soros is preposterous. It's the other way around. All right, a little more about this guy's background. I want you to really know who this guy is before we hear him, or while you're hearing him say these things. He is the president of George Soros' Open Society Foundation. Prior to his promotion to that, he served as vice president of Soros' Quantum Fund and vice chairman of Soros' fund management at the Open Society Institute. Him and Soros go way back, I believe the early 90s, maybe even the 80s. And when this dude moved to New York, he moved in next door to Soros in Westchester into one of Soros' houses. Soros rented it to him at well below market level, according to all the news on it. By all accounts, they're best friends forever, BFFs. And here's a little bit more of his resume. He was the chair of the United Nations Development Group. He previously was vice president for external affairs at the World Bank. He was the United Nations Deputy Secretary General. He was a Minister of State in the United Kingdom's Foreign Office who covered Africa and Asia. He was Vice Chair of the World Economic Forum, a member of the House of the Lords, or the House of Lords, an adjunct fellow at Chatham House's Queen Elizabeth Program. He's been knighted by the British government. He's the chairman of the board of Smartmatic. That's the election tech company that was at the center of a lot of the 2020 election controversy stuff, along with Dominion voting machines. He had been with them since 2014, and in his work as the Smartmatic board chair, he was hard selling America and other countries on internet-based balloting. I found stuff from the early 2000s of him doing that. I mean, he was an early change maker, as they call them, when it comes to the internet electronic voting stuff. And he was the lead partner at, and eventually the owner of, Sawyer Miller, a political consulting firm that was the subject of a 2009 book titled Alpha Dog, The Americans Who Turned Political Spin into a Global Business, which he's British. He just does a lot of manipulating of Americans, and this was his company, and it was an American company. The book is about how the group uses tricks of political campaigns to change the way that you think about foreign governments, big businesses, and any client in need of an image lift. In this book here, it describes how he helped overthrow Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines in 1986, as the Spectator mentioned earlier, and install the next president, who he calls Cory. It was Corazon Aquino. And this guy brags about some of this stuff. He's like Edward Bernays. He's happy about his manipulation. He got close to Cory by posing, this is the president he helped install, by posing as a foreign correspondent and eventually becoming her media advisor and speechwriter. Tactics he used to help overthrow the sitting president were a campaign of demonization against that president, producing an exit poll that indicated that this lady who he helped be installed as president, indicating she had won, that he got published on the front page of a newspaper over there, and according to him, this planted the idea that would be President Cory had defeated the incumbent president 55% to 45%. So, like, tactical, think about Stacey Abrams, stuff like this. And this was 86, so he's definitely modernized his tactics. Another tactic he used to help overthrow that president was preempting the victory announcement of the sitting president by getting Cory to record a victory speech that he wrote her, which he then released just as the polls were closing on the day of the election. He claimed that he knew Marcos was going to claim victory, so his plan was to preempt the guy's victory by doing it before him. And he used that exit poll that he threw together as statistical evidence in support of her claim to victory. So he fabricated a bogus poll, got a major newspaper to publish it on the front page, and then released a victory speech from his candidate barely after the polls had closed. Sounding very familiar. Speaking about that incident, he said, "The fact is, the counting of the Filipino ballot was expected to continue for 3 days. We were jumping the gun very deliberately on midnight that night. The other guy had gone to bed. The other guy was going to wait a couple of days before announcing that he had won in order to give his victory greater credibility." The book also discusses how this brown guy would regularly brief the CIA on such matters, something that he would just laugh about. All right, you get a sense of who he is. Let's get into these clips.
The question I was going to ask you was about institutions, about the long-term structure within which democracy functions. They clearly are pivotal to success. Can they also become fetter? How do we think about the role of institutions?
Well, Adam, thanks. And I think, you know, I'd hate to lose in Sam's very powerful response a core point that, you know, it's not so much that democracy is failing, it's that its attackers are attacking it. And I think, you know, it is behoves all of us at Davos, not this panel, which is very enthusiastic for democracy, but the sort of world-weary delegates or world-weary delegates about democracy out there to bear in mind that the most enthusiastic voices for democracy this week in Davos are the Ukrainian voices. Why? Because there's a country attacking their democracy. And, you know, we shouldn't all need that external threat to share Ukrainians' enthusiasm for a democratic future for all of us. And I think, you know, that's the right starting point.
That's the right starting point right there is, you know, we shouldn't all need that external threat. But I'll tell you, it sure helps them if they have that external threat. Ukraine being the most enthusiastic voice for democracy. Give me a break. The most enthusiastic voice for the international order. Now he's going on to his, I think, four lessons from his time. Mind you, he's the president of the Open Society Foundation. And here's the first one.
At Open Society, we spend an awful lot of money every year trying to support democracy and its institutions. I mean, just, I hope, Adam, without straying.
By support democracy and its institutions, he means trying to shape the elections and the future of those countries by installing the people who are going to do the bidding of him and his group's agendas.
In your question, I mean, you know, there were a couple of lessons which I'm not sure whether they're scientific or not, but you know, which I've seen watching our portfolio at work all over the world, is one, given the global demographics of an increasingly young population in many parts of the world, social movements are a better investment than political parties. Social movements are the funnel by which younger people come into politics. And whether I'm talking about the state of Georgia in the US or, you know, Latin America or Africa, you know, I see that in much of our work.
Okay, now we're talking. Social movements are a better investment than political parties. That's his first lesson, and he referenced the state of Georgia. Because the Open Society Foundation and George Soros have been the biggest donors, the biggest supporters of Stacey Abrams since she first started. The New Georgia Project, which was established to do exactly what he just said, to funnel young people into the Democrat Party to get them to vote to serve their agenda in the future. This is manipulation. And this is why Stacey Abrams, I say this all the time, she is and has always been, first and foremost, an activist organizer serving an agenda. She's been on the Soros payroll for a long time. Nobody's donated more money to her than Soros and Soros' family and the Open Society Foundation. They've made her rich and powerful. Why Stacey, though? So Stacey has shown, since she was in college, an exceptional ability to rile up young people, make them angry about one issue or another, and then mobilize them to action. She was good at that in college when she was at Spelman. She was actually called the rabble-rouser of the Rodney King riots in Atlanta. And that's exactly the type of skill set that Soros and this guy and their organization is looking for. Someone who can agitate young people, organize them, and compel them to action on demand. You get them engaged in the activism on behalf of the Democrat Party before they're even old enough to vote, and you funnel them. You herd them like cattle in the way that this guy is talking about, so that Soros and the Open Society Foundation can control them without them realizing they're being controlled and doing the bidding, not of Stacy, who they use because of her skills and because she looks like them. She can play the role well and she can sound like them. Stacy, when she's talking to activists, sounds far different than when she's on CNN or something. She is like a rabble-rousing preacher. The reality is she's manipulating them because she's getting paid to do it by these old rich white dudes who aren't even from America. And that's the agenda that all the people she's conning through her activism organizations are actually serving the needs of. She's not doing it to actually solve the issues that she riles people up about. Think about that language. Funneling them. Funnel them. It's a very depersonalized way of thinking about young minorities is what he's talking about. This is what he calls democracy, manipulating minorities, young minorities, through his trusted surrogate of them. They trust her, Stacey Abrams. This is how you stir uprisings, how you cause protest and chaos on the streets, which Stacey is great at doing. She has a history of doing that. All right, here's lesson two.
Secondly, election bodies and monitors is often not a very well placed investment. Disinformation and trying to contain that seems to have a much greater outcome in terms of whether the ones who really won get to claim that victory or not.
So he's talking about, you don't want to give money to the election monitors. That's not really where you can have influence. He's all about exercising the soft power, as his background mentioned, and manipulating people. And election monitors just watch. That's no good for him. He needs somebody, or he needs a strategy that he can manipulate and control the narrative. And that's what he's talking about, is investing in controlling the narrative, kind of like he did during that 1986 election, where he invested in controlling the narrative by conjuring up a poll out of nowhere, writing a story about how his candidate had won, getting it blasted all over the main newspaper, and then putting out a victory speech while the other guy was in bed planning to do his 2 days later. And a lot of this stuff sounds very familiar. Number three.
The third, and this is an obvious one, is the idea of democracy is much less powerful than the delivery of democracy. People are quite pragmatic nowadays. They're not terribly interested in many countries in being engaged in a civic debate about its values so much as is it delivering for us.
This is what I was talking about earlier. It's just all about the idea of democracy. That's how you mobilize people. It doesn't actually have to be democracy, because they're not going to stand around talking about it, having discussions about the principles. They don't care. They just use democracy to rile people up. Number four.
And a fourth one is a sort of stability versus change point. I spent a decade of my life as a political consultant all over the world, and some years into it, with one of my colleagues, was drinking Pisco Sours in Lima, Peru, a country whose own democracy is now under challenge. And he said, we've spent a lot of money around the world on polling. I think it all settles down to one line. Is this election about change or is it about stability? And in those days when I did this, they're about 50-50. But if you work that out, and if your candidate was a candidate of change in a change election, you won. With candidate of stability, you didn't, and vice versa. One of the challenges today is actually pretty much every election is about change. There is a deep, profound dissatisfaction with the status quo in nearly all our countries. And what's viewed as a vote against democracy and for populism, is often actually a vote against incumbency. Incumbents are not popular because they're not rising to the challenge of governance.
Again, that echoed the same theme as a previous one. This is why everybody, even those in power, pretend to be the little guy, the revolutionaries, even when they have control over everything. This strategy has actually helped him through Stacey Abrams. I've talked about this a lot. Stacey Abrams has risen in her career by losing. She's gotten wealthier and wealthier by losing, in large part because of George Soros and his Open Society Foundation and the work that she's done to serve this very agenda here. And by controlling and funneling those young people that they target through this activism into the Democrat Party, he is trying to control the future so he can shape the political agenda in the future. And Stacey always runs as that type of candidate because she's always lost. I'm sure she would if she won as well, but it'll be a little bit harder. And by doing that, even though she hasn't won, from his perspective and from the perspective of Soros, the people who are funding her and are the reason she's doing this, their agenda is absolutely being served. Expanding the electorate, capturing these young people, funneling them, as he says. Stacey Abrams has herded lots of young black people into the Democrat Party using these exact methods. So she is meeting her goals, the goals of the people who are paying her salary. I can't remember what's next. Let's see.
And I mean, I think all of us, whichever region of the world we come from, are living at a moment, if I can put it like this, without a paradigm. We know what the past was. We don't know what the future looks like. We know we came out of what people call a neoliberal order with a sort of market fundamentalist approach to making money and a limited view of what government's role should be. It's failed people everywhere, whether it's racial minorities in the United States or my own country, the UK, whether it's great groups of marginal people elsewhere. So, you know, that need for a paradigm which brings us all back onto the same terrain of what we expect from government, both nationally and globally, is for me a prerequisite to democracy working again, because democracy is between two teams on the same playing field. At the moment, they're playing on different playing fields.
So democracy is a new paradigm of a global order that doesn't allow people who dare ask a question about an election even run. They have to be rooted out, and that's what he's talking about there. And this guy who responds to him, I think that's what this next clip is, illustrates kind of that point that they're trying to get to.
The difficulty...
Oh, no, he's talking about the electronic voting systems right here.
Is that, you know, people are so spooked by the idea of this sort of black box nature of vote counting that, you know, we've failed to train our civil society partners in effectively monitoring these systems. So, you know, whether it was recent elections in Kenya and some other places I can name, well, I mean, Brazil, which has the Brazil system is the best in the world by anybody who I think, you know, follows these things. It has a branch of the judicial system supervising it. It spends 300 million, I think, every 5 years renewing its system. It's a model. And yet, of course, the whole purpose of this intervention last weekend, the attack on the Congress, came from the allegation that the election had been stolen, that it was fraudulent. You know, similar claims in Kenya and many other countries, often by our grantees. So, you know, I don't want to take sides on the point, but this...
I didn't know Brazil had the strongest elections on the planet, too. I thought we did, and it was 2020, but apparently... greatest elections ever. How can you even claim that there was any problems? They just used the same talking points.
Lack of sophistication about electronic systems is very damaging. And of course, you know, they're very easy to discredit because it is a machine counting the votes. And so the US system is going backwards. You know, the reaction to these extraordinary scenes of delayed counting in the 2020 election is not more electronics and updated machines. It's in many places to pull it back to hand voting, where in a highly politicized context, where one side has tried to replace secretaries of state and other election officials, it potentially, in the midterm, stopped a lot of this, but it was potentially, you know, creating a whole new avenue for electoral threats at the hand counting level. So, you know, I think it's time we kind of got a bit smarter about our election systems.
So he opposes hand counts, because that presents a new threat. I need to play this clip for Garland. I need to have him on again and have him respond. Again, this is the guy who's on the board of Smartmatic. He's involved in a lot of lawsuits that are currently ongoing, suing Sidney Powell, I think maybe the MyPillow guy, Newsmax, a whole bunch. I don't know if he's won any of them. I know a lot of them have been thrown out. But this is a dude who has his entire career manipulated the elections of countries around the world for the sake of his agenda. In control of these machines, saying, oh, we do no hand counts, terrible. Another tactic that he did during that campaign in 1986 in the Philippines is working on behalf of the woman he helped install. They used the strategy, and this is him talking about this. They would frequently call for Marcos, the sitting president, to a debate. And they did that all the time because they knew that he could not be separated long enough from the machine he needed to keep his kidneys going to attend a debate. I guess that is that dialysis? I'm not sure. That's cold. Now, with that said, about how we need to be more sophisticated and make everything all electronic, you know, because that can never get hacked. There can never be any problems with that, even though everything gets hacked all the time and nothing but cyber attacks are in the news lately. All right, I have one more clip from George Soros' bestie here. But before we get to that, I want to tell you what we're going to cover in the Drive Time News Blast XR, the subscription portion of the show, or subscriber-only portion of the show. And I'm going to play what I believe is the kind of a prototypical example of an atrocity story, a couple of stories being told very scriptedly in robotic fashion by a very attractive Ukrainian panelist who we heard from the other day, who in response to questions, she just started telling atrocity stories. At least that's what I think they are. So we're going to play that, analyze that in the DMB XR. If you want to get access to that, you can go to patreon.com/propagandareport and subscribe there today. All right, on to this last clip here. This is the moderator responding to what he said.
So the true nightmare that's revealed both in the US and the Brazilian case is it becomes political all the way down. So that you cannot make that neat division between what you might think is the mechanical process of simply deciding, yes, no, which box does this vote go in, and the inflamed global discussion about what's happening in American democracy or Brazilian democracy. And that, I mean, in our hemisphere have experienced, it's truly shaking when it happens to you. I mean, when you do not know whether the patently mathematically correct outcome of a counting process, we're not talking about calculus here, we're simply talking about adding numbers up, will not yield the outcome that it clearly should. And even that can be shaken. And this is where the mechanics do become quite important, because you need those to be as watertight, as transparent as possible.
These people, they call what they're doing democracy. It's not. It's like global fascism, corporatism. And then they call people who question elections that should be questioned, which is the very essence of democracy, is holding your government, is scrutinizing them, watching carefully. They call that anti-democratic authoritarianism. The very questioning of an election. Like, people who believe this, they have to be brain dead to think that the only way to support democracy is to support the idea that your government, your elections, should never be questioned, ever. I mean, you're just at the mercy of dictators and people like this if you embrace that idea. But they just hold up this fear of, look what happens if you question an election. It starts with Trump. It ends with Putin invading with tanks. I mean, that's like the line of thinking they want people to have. This photo up here looks like him and Soros are about to kiss. All right, well, I just wanted you guys to hear that for today. I'm going to keep an eye on some of the stuff that Stacey's doing still, because she is working behind the scenes, still getting funded by Open Society, Soros, guy runs the Open Society Foundation. And hearing him describe those tactics and looking into his background, it's renewed my interest in some of the strategies that Stacey Abrams is using, because they sound so similar. All right, thank you guys for listening. We'll talk to you next time. Have a fantastic rest of your day.